Well, that's the second and third bell. About time to begin this morning. I looked around the audience. I think I see one visitor among us. Appreciate his presence. We're going to flash through a fairly quick review and start in Exodus chapter 19. If you want to turn to there, that's where we'll kind of begin. I'm going to refer back to a couple of verses earlier than that for some things that I feel like I overlooked. Andy Swinford's going to lead us in prayer here in just a few moments so we can get the breakfast, the bacon and eggs out of our brain and get our minds on spiritual things and give me a chance to take a big deep breath and ask for a little bit of help here. But do appreciate everybody's presence this morning. Feels kind of like fall out there, doesn't it? Man, I like this. I can get used to it. Let's begin with prayer. Andy, if you'll lead us, then we'll begin our class. Yeah. I appreciate Andy's prayer. It struck me. He talked about taking things out of context. I know I was teaching 20 years ago at auditorium class, and I won't tell you the congregation, and I had a fellow sit on the front row and say, "Now, you're speculating. You're speculating." And I appreciate your patience with me as I try to tell these stories. Next is such a wonderful story to give you a narrative, to try to visualize the things that took place, the things that they saw, and try not to speculate, but whether they were in wilderness, whether they were in a meadow, whether they were on sand, what the mountain looked like, were things that we certainly don't know. But it helps me to, if it doesn't destroy the lesson, if it doesn't add to or take to the spiritual aspect, to get a visual image of what these people saw and their help qualify the experiences that they had so that we can relive those with us. We've been about 6 weeks so far in this class, and we started out in Exodus and were introduced to Moses in bondage after Joseph had long since passed. We have him introduced in the bulrushes and the growing up in Pharaoh's daughter's house. We have the him coming of age and slaying the Egyptian, fleeing to Midian, his first 40 years of life, and spending 40 years with Jethro that we talked about Wednesday night, and then being called in the burning bush on the mountain that we're going to consider this morning. He returns and they have the plagues, his meetings with Pharaoh. We have God making Himself known before the people, the death of the firstborn and the dedication of the firstborn, and then their departure through the Red Sea and the Song of Moses in chapter 15. They come out of the Red Sea, and I didn't ask this question, and I meant to as I raced through these lessons. What did they call the place where the water was bitter? Was it Marah? Remember Marah? Had we ever heard that before? Never heard that term before? Jeff's nodding his head. Somebody else remember where Marah was before? I had passed over that, but that was Naomi's name. Do you remember? After her sons had died and her husband had died in the first chapter of Ruth, maybe the second chapter of Ruth, Ruth 1:20, and she said, "Call me bitter, call me Marah." Now it's spelled just slightly different, but the the name is the same. And I thought of that that name. It rung to me as I taught the lesson. I meant to bring it up just as an interesting tidbit. Turn to chapter 16, verse 4. I wanted to ask you a question. Something else that I thought was interesting language that I taught the morning that we covered Exodus chapter 16. And it says when the Lord was talking to them, was introducing the idea to Moses of manna, in verse 4, he said, "A certain rate every day that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or not." What do you think? How, in what sense did God use manna? Why was manna a proof for them? Anybody give that any thought? We skimmed right over that, and I had never thought of manna being, it was food from heaven. It was a blessing, and yet God tells Moses that I'm going to prove them with manna. Anybody give any thought to that? They eventually got tired of it. They complained about it, another one of their murmurings, but the introduction of it was a proven, and that's kind of the answer here, that it seems that in all of their grumbling and complaining that had already begun, that God says, okay, it's just hunger that causes you a problem in our relationship, right? Well, let's see if that's what it is. I think the introduction of it was a proof for a test. I think how they handled it was a proof for a test. Lots of aspects of this, of all of the rules of this thing of just feed us. And even that became a test, didn't it? For every blessing that we have of God, we're to handle that blessing aright. We have to use that in a godly way. We have to deal with that as God has instructed. And God took their grumbling, responded to it, and said, "Now let's see how you deal with this." And the testing in the wilderness begins even as Mara, that he's introducing himself and their dependence upon him. When the manna comes, you remember what Jesus said about manna? You might remember how Jesus used that in almost an entire chapter in the Gospels. Do you remember how Jesus referred to the manna? That He was the bread of life. That God had provided food from heaven, but now He provides a prophet. And it's everlasting food. And he who feeds on this everlasting food will need no other. And so, this is a foreshadowing. This food that was there every day, and it saved them, it provided them sustenance, and they depended upon it, that Jesus brings back story, and we're going to see story after story of the events that we're studying right now that have so much import on God's relationship with man and God's relationship with us to help us to understand. I did not make sense in chapter 17. Didn't bring it up in my lesson. When they were at Rephidim, did you see them ask, "Is the Lord among us?" You remember let's see if I wrote that down. Verse 7, "And he called the name of the place Massa and Meribah because of the chiding of the children of Israel, because they tempted the Lord. Is the Lord among us? Is the Lord even among us?" Did you find that as striking? What would make that, to me, a confusing question? What was around them? What was in front of them? What was a daily experience? And they said, "Is God even here?" What makes that question curious? The cloudy pillar, the pillar at night. I mean, can you imagine last night, looking out your bedroom window and pulling the blinds because there is a fiery pillar that you see the presence of the Lord. The manna every morning. The Red Sea. We're 6 weeks into our lesson and we're 3 months into their journey. They just crossed on dry land and saw dead people floating among them. They saw major events just in a matter of a few weeks, and they were slave people being whipped and held in every aspect of their life, and now they're a free people journeying to the promised land by the hands of a Redeemer, and they ask, are you even among us? I never cease to be amazed by some of these things and how people react, and yet how we react too, with all of the evidences that we have. And these stories and God's creation around us, and we act as if God won't know. God doesn't know. God's not here. God's not helping me. What a woe is me for the life that I have. And blaming God, in a sense, for this life when we have so many blessings. And here they have so many blessings, and they're questioning even the presence of God. In verse 9 of chapter 17, I didn't make the point that this is the first time that we meet Joshua in this story, that he's one of the people that have been saved out of Joshua. They fight the Amalekites, and who does he call? It's Joshua, and we're going to see him as a growing character in our story. And this is the very first time that we're introduced to him, and I passed right over that. In the battle of the Amalekites, and they were nipping at the edges of the encampment, and God calls Joshua, or Moses called Joshua, and they slay them with Moses on the top of the mountain. And what name is given to God by Moses at that time? See, I didn't make a note out of it in my lesson. Yahweh was I Am, so Yahweh had already been introduced to them, but this was Yahweh Nissi, which was He is a banner over me. And that was we're going to see a couple of names over the storyline of Exodus where, because of his behavior and God's revelation to them and how he revealed to them, they're going to give him a name, and God was a banner. And I sing a little song to the kids when we've had that of God is a banner over me, his love. And here Moses, as he stood on that mountaintop, for these slaves and their first battle cry and the reassurance that God provided, that look up on that mountain. Every time the battle got tough, they looked up on the mountain and there was Moses with his hands raised. And that was a reassurance for them. And God knows that we need reassurance. We need to know that He's there. And that was such a neat term to me, that God is my banner. He's the sign. He's the neon sign on top of that mountain. Chapter 18, as we rush along, I was going to skip this, but Justin Roof insisted I cover father-in-laws because I reminded him so much of Jethro. The story of Jethro, we're introduced to Gershom and Eliezer, and Jethro comes from Midian having spent so much time and evidently bonded with Moses. And it's just interesting to me, in a lesson that I'm sure Rob and you guys discussed Wednesday night, of how Jethro dealt with Moses. And us in-laws, oh, we have lesson after lesson over in-laws. When we give advice, we need to tremble. We need to be asked for advice. Parents, when our kids leave our household, advice is a scary, scary thing. And we see here, as in verse, see if I got too far here. In verse 14, and when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did to the people, it seems as when Jethro comes out that Moses goes and meets him, he's excited that he's there. They offer sacrifices. All the elders are gathered because Jethro is there, and Jethro rejoices over the treatment of Moses and his success, and this great people and God's expression to these people. And Jethro offers sacrifices, and then, you know, the in-laws are there. They're going to be here for a while. He settles in and he watches and he observes. And we see later in the chapter, verse 18, that Jethro comes to him and says, you're going to kill yourself. You know, I'm watching you from daylight to dark, and I see these things that are going on. And it was interesting to me that when Jethro offers this advice in verse 23, he starts it with, if you're going to do this thing, if I can just offer you an observation here. You know, sometimes as parents, as father-in-laws, as grandparents, or whatever our role is, we know, we've been there, you need to do this, and if you don't do it, well, you're stupid. I can say that, yeah. If Jaden was in here, I couldn't say stupid. What are you thinking? I told you this would happen. See what happens when you do this. We can be tough as parents and grandparents and in-laws, can't we? It seems as though Jethro and Moses had a very neat relationship. There was that Jethro was a leader of the leader. He was the leader of the prophet. What a wonderful position, and evidently carried himself, because when he would leave, he begged him not to go. Y'all do that with your in-law? Don't leave. I need you. I want you here. We need to think about that. We need to think about our relationship with our children and their spouses, and it needs to be a positive thing, and it takes a lot of work to do that. And we need to be conscious of it, because it's a relationship we're going to have for a long, long time, hopefully. And it can be very good, or it can be very painful and stressful. The second part of that advice was, if you'll do this, if this is what you're going to do, and if God be with you, that His advice was hinging upon being in sync with God's will. And that's what needs to temper and tone our advice. Chapter 19, we catch back up. Rob started in chapter 19, and as I pretend to do, get very rushed in the last few verses, and he suggested that we go back and restart. I appreciate Rob teaching, by the way. Scott is out again this morning taking Cameron to FC College. Here we arrive. The cloud has moved from Rephidim. They stayed for some number of days at Rephidim. They destroyed the Amalekites. God told Moses to put this in a book, and I want them utterly destroyed eventually. You remember this, and you tell Joshua, and this is going to happen. These people that would prey on our weak, I want them utterly destroyed. And he told him to write that in a book. So they come to Sinai. And Sinai is a desert. It's a wilderness. It's a mountain range. We're not sure exactly where they are, but as we drew the triangle and showed the picture, 150 miles on one side, 180 miles on the other, 150 miles across, almost a perfect triangle, they're probably somewhere in the southernmost tip of this Sinai Peninsula. We're thinking it's probably Jebel Musa, if I'm pronouncing that right, but a particular mountaintop. There's a number of mountains that historians think may be it, but this is one that through history and archaeology and folklore and all those things, it's an 8,000 foot mountain peak, and it has a valley beneath it on the northwest side, which would have been their approach. And this valley was 2.5 miles wide, long, and 1/2 mile wide. And they would approach this as following the pillar, and they come to this place. They're going to spend the next 11 months. This is the third month. We had Abib, we had Ziph, and we're at Sivan now. The third month, we don't know exactly what day they arrive, but they arrive, and they're going to spend the next 11 months in this encampment. And through this story and this encampment, we're going to see the rest of Exodus, all of Leviticus, and Numbers through chapter 11. A lot of time, a lot of things occur here. The tabernacle is going to be built. The priests are going to be assigned. The laws are going to be given. The priestly vestments are going to be created. All of the contents of the tabernacle are going to be created, and we'll get to this later. And I have thought in my mind, you know, I brought my little Omer last, I think it was last week, I brought my Omer, which was frosted flakes. I wanted to bring scarlet and purple and gold and give us the sense of the time and the expense and the beauty of this creation that they're going to have. This month, Sivan, is about right now. About right now, June, July, is when they're arriving at Mount Sinai. 2.5 million people before this mountain crest. I think I checked it once before that maybe Monsanto is 2,500 to 3,000 foot elevation. Fairly stark as you come into Huntsville, or even look at it from here in the night sky and see the radio towers on it. A fairly impressive mountain, twice as tall as that, three times as tall maybe, out of the desert floor. They approach this mountain and then camp and see this huge mountain before them. And Moses goes to the mountain as the campment is being set up, and he appeals to God. In verse 3, Moses went up to God, and the Lord called unto him out of the mountain, saying, Thou shalt say unto the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on the eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. The dialogue begins. When was the last time that Moses was... Well, has Moses ever been here before? He was here, wasn't he? This was the burning bush. He had been here before. 500 years later, Elijah is going to be here. Do you remember that? Elijah is going to flee the land of Canaan and come down there for all of the oppression that he's experiencing, and he's going to hide in this very mountain. And the ground is going to shake, and thunder is going to occur, and we're going to hear 500 years later that God will cease to teach in this way because there's coming a prophet. 500 years earlier, God's going to speak, and we have a foreshadowing of the Word and God's presence and the power and the greatness in Exodus chapter 19. I did bear you on the eagle's wings. Verse 5, Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then shall I be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And these are the words which you shall speak unto the children of Israel. Bob spends a lot of time in his book, in various places in his book, talking about what does Bob talk about the language of the covenant? What does he keep saying? If you shall be my people, then I shall be your God. Just in various ways that he expresses this, conditional, isn't it? Our relationship with God today is conditional. God gives them rules, and they've got to abide. These are not things that are just given to them. The manna wasn't just given to them. They had to react to it. And it's so peculiar to me that the stories that we have all the way from childhood, from our earliest stories all the way through life, and I don't know what denomination you talk about, the same stories are told, and they were always conditional. But we get to adulthood, and we leave our family homes, and we go find our own self in religion, and our children find their own self and find ourselves in religious situations where it's by the grace of God, I ain't got to do nothing. I'm saved and I can't fall from grace. And I don't see that ever. We never see that. And yet the world clings to that, and there's a lot of reasons why. I mean, there's there's sermon after sermon and study after study after study, but these are lessons that we learn here that everything with God is conditional. And we need to be aware of it. We need to know what those conditions are. And we need to fight to stay within His mandates and within His light and teach them to our children and understand the consequences that we're going to see in these people as they measure themselves against Jehovah. He says, you're going to be a treasure to me. You think of yourself as a treasure. You're going to be a peculiar people. And sometimes we feel very peculiar, don't we? We're going to be a nation of priests. They're going to be a nation of priests. Now, they didn't have a priesthood yet, as defined by in the New Testament and later on when they look back at the relationship of God with man. This is going to be the first organized religion that the Israelites are going to know, or God's people, before it was the patriarchal age, and we really don't have many references to that in the New Testament, but this is the beginning where God defines His relationship by laws and statutes and behavior, not coming in and talking to the head of the household, but things that they knew they were to do, and everybody that was a member of this nationhood would know what defined their relationship with God. he used the word priesthood, and God always had priests. I mean, Melchizedek, there were priests that people were familiar, but now you're going to be a nation of priests. You're going to be a nation. Even that was new to them. Everything about this covenant was unique, and it was special, and it was significant. So Moses took these words of God. God said, you take this to the people. And as the encampment was being built, and they're before this 8,000-foot elevation, and Moses, evidently, as we go through chapter 19, we see that Moses goes up, and he comes down, and he goes back. As he's busy about, see if the bush is still burning, going back and seeing these places that he spent 40 years earlier, some 43 years earlier, he sets the camp up, he comes back down, he talks with the elders, and gathers the elders, and of course Jethro helped him establish these leaders of thousands and hundreds and fifties and tens, and he gathers them together, and he says, God is going to come before you on the third day. We've been traveling, we fought a battle some days ago, we're before this Mount Horeb, and everybody needs to sanctify themselves. It says the people went about washing their clothes and getting ready, that something special is going to happen. And in verse 9 it says, and the Lord said unto Moses, lo, I come to thee in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with thee and believe thee forever. And Moses told the words of the people, unto the Lord. I meant to ask that as a question. Why did God come down in a cloud? We see Himself manifest in the cloud and the pillar and the destroyer angel that kills the firstborn. And here He answers my question without me telling the story exactly right, to say, I'm going to come down. I'm going to hide myself in a cloud because I want the people to hear me. You know, up until this point, he's been talking to Moses. Moses has been talking to Aaron. Aaron comes and talks to the people. But here he goes, already seeing a little murmuring, already seeing the nature of these people and the tendency of these people. So I'm going to come down and I'm going to talk to them, and they're going to hear me, or I'm going to talk to you, but they're going to hear me talk to you. What a spectacle. They had to prepare themselves for that. And we've heard lessons talk about preparing ourselves for coming for worship services, coming into the presence of the Lord. I don't know if that's the place for those thoughts here, but this was significant, and Moses made it clear to the people. You need to cleanse yourselves. You need to take the thoughts and the pleasures of your marriage relationship and going to the kiddie carnival and things that keep you busy in the day, and you need to just get those out of your mind, because on the third day, you're going to meet the Lord. I'm not going to tell you about Him, but you're going to meet the Lord. This image of the Lord coming down, he said that in verse 16, and it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount, and the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud, so that all the people that was in the camp trembled. And Moses brought them to the nether parts of the camp. Now he had told them, in addition to sanctifying themselves and to tone down your personal relationships here, because you need to mentally get prepared for this and spiritually get prepared for this, but I don't want anybody to approach the mountain. Don't you touch it. Don't you come close to it. And I don't know, he's going to say that if anybody comes and touches anything or steps foot on the mountain, that they'll be consumed. They may be shot through. And I read several verses. There's a reference to it in Psalms. I don't know if he had his army. There were people. There were soldiers. There was Joshua that was standing on a rock looking down on these people and say, that's the line right there. Don't come any closer. Or if these were darts and arrows, if this was a lightning bolt that Jehovah was going to send down to them if they got too close. But the boundaries were well defined. You think the faithful people approached that line? Now we're going to hear the story and we're going to see what happened and even what was a concern on Moses' part about happening, but based on what we're going to see and know that happened in this, and the story unfolds about what they experienced, witnessed, heard, saw, and felt, I can't imagine approaching that mountain. But you know, when we have our boundaries defined for us today, we have no problem pushing it just as close as we can. He doesn't really care. That won't be a problem. I shouldn't have to worry about that. That's not significant. We push the boundaries, don't we? And we're God's faithful. They did too. In verse 18, and Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked, and quaked greatly. Deuteronomy chapter 4, chapter 5, I think. There's several verses, but there are other... Hebrews chapter 12, verses 18 and following. There are several references back to this event, and it uses language like smoke and fire, blackness, darkness, a tempest, thunder, lightning, and earthquake. And it said in verse 19, and when the voice of the trumpet sounded long, and longer, and louder. Evidently this trump, whether it was of the trumps of the people of Israel, or whether this was a heavenly trumpet that sounded, but it must have blared from that mountain. And it shakes me to think about that. It grew louder and louder. And it says, Moses spake, and God answered him and the voice. What Moses said. I mean, he's on the mountain, they're behind the people, they've got boundaries, all of this begins, the cloud in the morning and the thunderings and the lightnings and terror. And it says Moses spake. Do we know what Moses spake? Anybody know what Moses spake? It tells us in Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 21. And so terrible was the sight that Moses said, I'm scared to death, my knees are shaking. I don't think he said it that way. I couldn't get too dramatic with it. I exceedingly fear and quake. That Moses stood in this and was scared to death and shook. Have you got that image? I tell you what, been there, done that. It'll scare you to death. Being in the presence of God will make you tremble. And these people, I tell you what, that ain't nothing like what they saw, though. I've shook and I've trembled and I've sweaty palms and I've clenched the top of a pew, but it wasn't nothing like what they saw. From Exodus chapter 19, verse 19, there's actually a break. Let's jump over to chapter 20 and verse 18, because it tells us a little bit about what happened. Evidently what's happened is they've set up the camp, and Moses goes and he comes and he gets the information from God, and he tells the elders, and the elders circulate the information before the people. They set the boundaries. All of this thing is happening. They come, and all of this begins, and in the midst of that thundering and that lightning and that quaking and that shaking and the darkness and the cloud and the smoke that's rising from that, I see it as being that pillar of cloud that it goes skyward to heaven. That out of the midst of that, you know what they hear? I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. The Ten Commandments are spoke verbally. You remember why he said he's going to come down in the cloud? Because I'm going to talk to you and they're going to hear what I say. And if I gather this context right, that's what he says. And he talks to them and he speaks. the beginning of the laws and the statutes that would govern the nation of Israel right there from their presence, 8,000 feet in front of them, with all of this noise going on and a voice, I don't know what it sounded like. I sure can't make it. But in chapter 20, verse 18, it says, "And all the people saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they removed and stood afar off." It scared them to death too. I wouldn't need anybody with an arrow pointing at me to keep me from coming up there and touching it. I'd been running back toward Egypt, I guess, or somewhere out there in the cactus-filled desert to get away from all of this. It did that to them. It scared them to death. In verse 19, they said unto Moses, "Speak thou with us, and we'll hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die." And Moses said unto the people, "Fear not, for God has come to prove you, that His fear may be before your faces, that ye sin not." And the people stood afar off, and Moses drew near unto the thick darkness where God was. This was a terrible sight. When Moses delivered this message to them and said, "This is what's going to happen the third day, and this is what happened the third day," how did they respond in verse 8? Before it happened, and he tells them what's going to happen, "If you will obey and heed and listen and do my will, I'm going to make you a great nation. I'm going to be your God." And what did they say? "We'll do it. We're all in. We're ready. We agree." What happens in 6 weeks? They build the golden calf, don't they? You know, it's less than 6 weeks before that happens. 6 weeks later, after this, Moses stays too long up on the mountain. Aaron gets nervous. The people come complaining to him. We'll study that later. 6 weeks. So the people stood afar off, and Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was. Back up to verse 20 of chapter 19. This, The chronology here kind of skips around to get the narrative and the story of what's going on. And the Lord came down upon the mountain, the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain. And Moses went up. So evidently this, even the blaring of the trumpets, the dissension of the cloud, the thunderings, the quakings, this wasn't the return of Christ in the clouds and a twinkling of an eye that everything changes. This was a spectacle that lasted, that they beheld. And after it scared them to death, and after Moses came back down and calmed the people, and they said, "You go back up there. I'm glad, appreciate him coming down and talking to us, but that's enough. We'd rather him just talk to you." Moses goes back up, and this time, instead of being before them and letting God speak to them in their hearing, that evidently Moses is called to the top, and he went on up. And if you walk to the top of Mount Sinai, and I haven't, by the way, don't plan on it, not going to jog, not going to do that, but that's part of the river race or these 10K runs that they run up the mountain. That's supposed to be a torturous trip to go up to the top of Monsanto, I guess, and come back down. Triple it. Moses climbs to the top. This had to take a while. All of this took a while. And when Moses gets up there, the Lord said unto Moses, "Go down and charge the people, lest they break through unto the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. And let the priests also which come near to the Lord sanctify themselves, lest the Lord break forth upon them." Anybody make any sense out of this to me? Remember, I'm running back to Rephidim. I'm going back where our last successful battle was. And here we have the quakings and the thunderings and the lightnings and the... Isn't that strange to you? Anybody make any sense out of that? It's a stiff-necked people. I'm open if anybody's got any words on this. All I can figure is he was up there again for a long time. And to make sense out of it that, you know, if that tornado that came through on April the 27th had gone on and on and on, well, I was foolish enough in my office to watch it go by. I was sitting there with a cup of coffee. Stupid, again. But I it wasn't affecting me, and I could see it, and I was impressed and in awe, and stupid. But for hours, days, I don't know how long this lasted, but evidently we become comfortable with this little God that we have defined. That's the only way I could make sense out of it, that they got comfortable with it. And there was a concern on Moses' part that you need to get back down there. You need to go down there because they're going to come up. And if these priests come up, I'm going to break on them. I'm going to come down on them. We do that. We have these pictures and these images and saying, I'd be in Rephidim. But the truth is, if we were there, those were not unlike us and those people. And we do that today. Moses questioned God, said, you've defined the bounds. It's impossible. There's no way they're going to come up here. And what does God say? Get down there. Get thee down, it says in verse 24. And the Lord said to him, away, get thee down, and thou shalt come up, and thou, and Aaron with thee. But let not the priest and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break forth upon them. And Moses went down unto the people, and he spake to them. I think so. I think all of this took longer time. And I must have missed a bell. People are coming out. Let's end it there. Appreciate your attention. There are people in the lobby, but I never heard the bell. So Jehovah was talking too loud, I guess. We will pick up in chapter 20 Wednesday night. I don't hear that.